Hello, and welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jason Harris. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode of our Rare Cancer series, we spoke with Dale R. Shepherd, MD, PhD, about desmoid tumors, a rare condition that primarily affects people aged 35 to 40 years, especially women of childbearing age. Dr. Shepherd, director of the sarcoma and phase 1 programs at the Taussig Cancer Center at Cleveland Clinic, said the condition can be misdiagnosed because physicians often do not consider the possibility of tumors in younger patients. Desmoid tumors, also known as aggressive fibromatosis, share some characteristics of cancers, specifically unchecked cell growth. However, they do not invade nearby structures and they do not metastasize. Desmoid tumors are rarely fatal. 87% of patients were alive at 15 years in one retrospective study, but larger lesions and those adjacent to neurovascular structures may cause pain and functional impairment. In today's podcast, Dr. Shepherd discussed the unpredictable course of desmoid tumors, the use of TKIs to treat the condition, and findings from two trials presented at the 2022 ESMO Congress that may represent new treatment options for these patients. Thank you, Dr. Shepherd, for joining us this afternoon. For desmoid tumors, we say rare cancers. Exactly how rare are we talking?
Yeah, desmoid tumors are rare. I think that if you look at the literature, you would see that the incidence of desmoid tumors is probably in the 1,000 to 2,000 cases a year range in terms of new diagnoses. So a pretty rare type of tumor.
Now, strictly speaking, these aren't cancers, correct? So why are they treated by oncologists?
Yeah, that's actually one of the things I lead with when I see patients in clinic, because they're seeing me in a cancer center and they're always a little worried because people have usually told them they're not a cancer. And the reality is that they're not a cancer. They're something we kind of put in a category of aggressive benign tumors. They're kind of like cancers because they grow in an uncontrolled way. They're not like cancers because they don't invade into nearby structures and they don't metastasize. And so they can grow and cause some troubles, but they wouldn't be considered a cancer. Now, historically, some of the treatments that we use to treat desmoid tumors are some of the drugs that we also can use to treat cancers. So that's one of the reasons oncologists, I guess, are sort of called upon to treat these usually.
Are there risk factors you can point to for people who are most likely to develop desmoid tumors?
Yeah, so if you look at risk factors, it's not entirely clear what all the risk factors would be. We do know something about characteristics of patients who get them. Most cases, patients have no underlying risks or genetic changes that might suggest that they would get one. This is what we call sporadic desmoid tumors. There are patients that have FAP, or familial adenomatous polyposis, which is a hereditary condition. And those patients, there's actually a gene abnormality that would predict that they might be more likely to get desmoid tumors. There's a hormonal component, we think, that's associated with desmoid tumors. And so pregnancy can make desmoid tumors either grow or become apparent. And there's also some suggestion that trauma or injury might trigger the development of a desmoid tumor.
Typically, desmoid tumors aren't fatal, correct? But what kind of effect can they have on the quality of life?
Yeah, so in most cases, you're correct. A desmoid tumor isn't usually fatal, but they can cause a lot of problems. And so I guess we'll talk about the most serious part first. Oftentimes, patients that have FAP-associated desmoid tumors, that tumor is in their abdomen, oftentimes associated with the mesentery. And so by the involvement of the mesentery, you can get bowel obstructions, you can get abdominal pain. They can actually cause some pretty significant complications. And they can, in fact, be fatal if they grow to the point where they're pinching off blood supply to the bowels and things like that. In most cases, particularly in patients with spontaneous desmoid tumors there in the extremities, they're maybe in the abdominal wall, but not inside the abdomen. The primary issue is that they can grow, they can cause pain, really from a discomfort or even a disfiguration standpoint. I've had patients with them up in the axilla, up in the armpit, and they'll grow and they'll cause numbness and tingling and weakness in the hand because they're pushing on nerves. So they're not really invading into a structure causing problems, and they're certainly not going to be fatal, but people can have significant loss of function of an arm, for instance, if a desmoid happens to be in the wrong place. There can also, just because of the pain involved, the chronic nature, there are issues with depression. Some patients will become addicted to pain medications if someone's trying to treat their desmoid tumors with opioids, for instance. So there can be some significant psychosocial issues as well.
I've read that as many as one-third of DTs are misdiagnosed initially. Why are they so hard to spot, and how do you reduce that number?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in many cases, these are tumors that do primarily occur in younger people. They can occur pretty much throughout a person's life, but most common would probably be in patients 20s through 40s. That's kind of a group where you don't immediately think of a tumor if somebody has pain, for instance. So if they have pain in an arm or a leg, you might not immediately be looking for, you know, a tumor as the cause of that. And so sometimes it's not until these have grown to a fairly large size. Patients may have already been to a provider or two, they've been sent to physical therapy, and eventually somebody might do imaging and find it. And so sometimes it's just a delay simply because we may not be thinking tumor is one of our first reasons for a patient's symptoms in that age group.
I know surgery is the primary treatment. Are there other systemic treatments available?
Yeah, so that's actually where probably the biggest changes have been taking place within desmoid tumors. Currently, there's actually some exciting things happening. But even more recently, it's become more established that active surveillance, simply watching these and having the patients to have a patient watch these, is maybe the right call in a lot of cases, particularly if patients have a desmoid tumor that's not causing a lot of symptoms and doesn't appear to be growing very quickly. And so, as you mentioned, surgery has historically been something where we sort of see something, take it out. And patients oftentimes will say, well, I have a tumor and I want it out. But the reality is that these are tumors that they don't invade into nearby structures, but they're not necessarily a well-defined mass. And so even if a surgeon takes it out and they think they got it all, it usually comes back. The recurrence rate is pretty high. And so patients can have a surgery that can be somewhat involved, but then end up with a recurrence and need some other management as well. So the first move, quite honestly, in many cases is just to, once it's identified, get a fairly short interval scan just to see if it's growing or not, particularly in patients that don't have a lot of symptoms. There are systemic therapies available. Historically, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories can have some benefit. Now, there's a little bit more controversy now, more recently, on whether we should just watch people or perhaps use something like a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. But certainly the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, something like a cousin drug to Motrin, can help with pain and may also help stabilize disease growth.
For active surveillance, is it something where the patient is coming in for imaging, or is it something they can do from home?
Usually it's something that if we're going to be watching someone with surveillance, that typically would be looking really just at imaging of the site where the tumor is located. Again, these are not things that are likely to spread or metastasize. So you don't have to do PET scans. You don't have to do whole body scans. You really are just looking at an ultrasound, a CT scan, an MRI of the area that's involved. That first look, I oftentimes will look in 2 to 3 months after I've had a patient show up that has one of these desmoid tumors. And then sometimes we just watch them on an every 3 to 6 month basis, particularly in patients that don't have really tumor growth or if they don't have any symptoms.
Is a cure something that's possible, or is this a lifelong condition?
Historically, the right answer was that this is a chronic disease. We're not likely to cure this. Cure meaning that we give a therapy and it disappears forever. Now, there are patients that have small desmoids. They're surgically resected and they don't come back. I mean, so in that case, yes, you could cure it. But oftentimes we do have those recurrences and there's a limit to how much surgery you can do to continue to remove them. And with the treatments that we had in the past, it was not likely that we were able to cure it, that we were able to make it disappear. Now, that being said, when you mentioned about systemic therapies, there are actually other systemic therapies available. I talked about non-steroidal anti-inflammatories as maybe a first step. There is tyrosine kinase inhibitors, a drug called pazopanib and a drug called sorafenib, that are both drugs that we use for other types of cancer, but can control the growth of desmoid tumors. And so those have been available for 2 or 3 years. And then to your question about cure, there are 2 new drugs that are being developed. And one of those drugs, actually in a recent clinical trial, there were patients that had a complete response. Complete response meaning they did a scan and there's nothing left. It's early to know if we'll still get recurrences, but until now, we did not have any systemic treatments that would entirely eliminate a tumor, and now we might.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about some new evidence that's been published recently. So we'll start with the Ringside trial, which was a pivotal phase 2-3 clinical trial evaluating the drug AL102. And in about 30 patients, we had 1 confirmed PR and 2 unconfirmed PRs, plus 8 patients with stable disease. That doesn't seem like a great response. So I guess, what do we do with those findings?
Looking at that particular trial, that particular drug, this is a new category of treatments. It's a signaling pathway inhibitor, much like the 2 tyrosine kinase inhibitors I just mentioned. But this is it has a different target called a gamma secretase inhibitor. We have not used those in the past for desmoid tumors, and there are 2 of them, the 2 trials that you mentioned. The drug that is being tested in this Ringside trial is still very, very early in development. It's still letters and numbers, AL102. And I think when we think about responses, you have to put that in a backdrop and in the perspective of even common cancers that we use chemotherapies that we sort of all are aware of, sometimes the response rates are pretty low. Sometimes the actual number of patients that have tumor shrink can be in the 10 or 15 or 20% range. So as an overall response, some of these actually look pretty promising. Another way to frame the data that we know so far from this particular drug is that they looked at response by looking at volume of tumor. What was the tumor volume? And what was the size as sort of as you measure across, something we call RECIST criteria to measure response. And they looked at 2 time points in the early part of the trial. They looked at scans at 16 weeks and scans at 28 weeks. Now, various people are in the trial for varying lengths of time at this point, but at the 16-week point, there were 9 patients. 1 of them had a response, and 8 of them, their tumor wasn't growing. It's what we call stable. Back to that thought that, you know, sometimes if we can keep it from growing and causing symptoms, that's a win. But 7 of those patients had less tumor. And so of the 9 patients, 1 had a known response and 8 of them had a stable disease that didn't meet the criteria, enough of a shrinkage of tumor to be called a partial response. But 7 of them had less tumor. And when you go to the 28-week point, there were 3 patients and 2 of those patients had responded. 1 of them had stable disease and all of the patients had less tumor than at 16 weeks. And so that's one thing we find with these desmoid tumor therapies. They don't work quickly. And so even the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, all the things we have at our disposal, don't work fast. And so pretty encouraging that at 28 weeks, there were only 3 people that had made it to that point. I mean, we're talking half a year of treatment, but all of them had less tumor and 2 of them had less tumor to the point where it's considered a partial response. So that's pretty promising. That trial is getting ready to open into an expanded portion of where we're going to be treating more patients at that particular dose to see what the responses are. So that trial is just getting into that second phase. So we'll hopefully have some even more encouraging data for that particular trial soon.
You expect that over time, the results will continue to improve because, like you said, these drugs just don't work that fast.
Correct. So if I were to have used one of our traditional tyrosine kinase inhibitors, pazopanib or sorafenib, at 16 weeks, I would have a response in some patients, but not everybody. I might still continue to get more patients with responses as I continue to treat them. So I find this to be pretty encouraging. One of the more encouraging parts of it is that this drug and the drug that's also being developed as a gamma secretase inhibitor seem to be really well tolerated. And so the toxicity of these is really good at this point.
You just alluded to it, the other drug, nirogacestat, in the DeFi trial, which is a phase 3 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And there you had a pretty significant ORR improvement compared with placebo, 41% versus 8%. That seems like it's a really big difference for patients, but you know, when you look at it, what do you see?
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is another one that this looks like a pretty promising drug. This was another trial that was also presented at ESMO recently. In terms of the data, I talked about tyrosine kinase inhibitors, for instance, or nonsteroidals, that it's important to realize that as a rare tumor, there is not a single FDA approved drug for this disease at this point. And so if you were to look for an FDA indicated drug, it doesn't exist. That's the reason why this particular trial in a phase 3 setting was compared to placebo. There wasn't really a standard drug that patients would get. So in a placebo controlled trial, if you were to look at the primary endpoint in this trial was progression-free survival, how long did patients have before they started to have progression? In this particular trial, there was a 71% reduction in risk of progression, which is huge. I mean, that's a really big response in terms of being able to give a therapy and have a really long period of time before the patient starts to progress compared to placebo. And as you mentioned, the response rate, 41% of patients had responded compared to 8%. And from an extent of response perspective, the 7% of the patients had a complete response. And so that means that when you look at their scans, there's nothing left. And so that's pretty significant. Between stable disease, and again, if I have a patient that has small volume tumor, not having really having symptoms, if I can keep that disease stable, not growing, they have a thing in their abdominal wall and just sits there and it's not doing anything, not causing them any trouble. This particular trial, the stable disease rate was 50%. So that's kind of huge. So between stable disease at 50%, response rate of 41%, that means 91% of patients didn't have their tumor grow. That's pretty impressive. Also in this trial, they looked at quality of life measures. They looked at patient-reported outcomes, and those all favored the study drug compared to placebo.
We talked earlier about how these aren't exactly cancers, and it seems like, especially in this situation, because stable disease, it seems like a really positive outcome for these patients. So in that sense, it's also a little bit different than a cancer.
You know, one of the reasons chemotherapy hasn't traditionally worked particularly well for these, even in a setting where they're growing fairly slowly, there are chemotherapy options that we had tried in the past. And so that would be from a systemic therapy, something else available. But if we can get a drug that is well tolerated, improves patients' quality of life, and keeps it from growing, that's a huge win.
Are there any other systemic therapies that you're looking at or any other research you're excited to see reported?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, quite honestly, it's... You know, these things become a little bit like feast or famine. I mean, we hadn't really had anything new. It's interesting with desmoid tumors, I guess. The pazopanib and sorafenib that we use as systemic therapies, those were both presented at an ASCO meeting in the exact same session back in 2018 or 19. Interestingly, these two trials, and there's been really nothing new since that time, these two trials were both presented at the exact same conference earlier this month. So this really looks like the most promising target being tested right now. And it looks like we have two drugs that really could significantly change the landscape.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Dale R. Shepherd. And thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.